Right, so introducing extended models could help explain some unsolved problems such as neutrino oscillation, dark matter, and baryon asymmetry. So you probably all know this, but you can write the matrix element for particle the picture doesn't really show up on here, but you might be able to see it a little bit. It just shows two particles interacting, exchanging meson here. So you can write the matrix element like this, and if you simplify it in the high energy limit, you'll get this in terms of S, the Mandelstam variable.
Sorry,
yeah.
We can't really see the final diagram. Is
I know.
It possible to draw it on the blackboard?
Yeah. Maybe I should check if the other ones are all bad too, because hang on. Or it's okay. I can just draw it. It's just the two particles coming in, two particles coming out. So I'm just going to be using it later on in the talk. So one thing, yeah? Well, it's just in general. Like, I'm going to use specific examples later on. Like, just two particles coming in, two particles coming out. Yeah?
This matrix element you've written, does that involve the Higgs?
Yeah, like the propagator in between is the Higgs.
This is a propagator.
The Higgs boson, yeah. It's the one right here. But
now I'm asking about the first line, the matrix.
Yeah. Yeah. Sorry, what are you asking?
What process is this?
What process?
Yeah.
Well, it's just two particles annihilating, and then.
So, what are those two particles? That's what.
I didn't specify what they are because they're going to be like gauge bosons, or later on, I'll write something else for that. Okay. So the Higgs boson is a scalar particle, so it can be represented by the Klein-Gordon Lagrangian. In particular, you can represent it as a doublet. So here there's a positive and neutral component. And this can be split up into 4 degrees of freedom, so phi 1, phi 2, phi 3, phi 4. The Lagrangian for the Higgs field can be written like this. And here d mu is a particular covariant derivative, where b and w are different field strength tensors. And g and g prime are coupling strengths. So, right. For the potential energy written before, if negative mu squared is greater than zero and then lambda is also greater than zero, we'll have spontaneous symmetry breaking. And this is when the vacuum state, so the minimum energy states, is non-zero. And so the particle will fall into one of two different potential wells. So at the minimum state, if we minimize the potential, we get phi dagger phi equals V squared over 2. And here V is the vacuum excitation value for the Higgs field. So experimentally, that was found to be 246 GeV about. And so you can choose a gauge where the positive component, positively charged component of the Higgs doublet is 0. And so you can just write the Higgs particle H as deviations from the vacuum V. I'm not really sure, but there's some experiments that can do that. Yeah, sorry. Okay. All right. So particles will couple to the Higgs boson, and that will generate their mass. So mass terms in the Lagrangian will be of this form. And so if we look at the Lagrangian I wrote on a page or two back, this will give the mass of the Higgs boson to be root 2 lambda v squared from the kinetic term. So you can do about the same thing for the W and Z boson for the Lagrangian written before, and that will give the mass, the masses written there. So the actual physical particles are the W plus and W minus. So that's those are linear combinations of the W1 and W2. So in extended Higgs models, we add more multiplets to the Higgs doublet. So for example, a two Higgs doublet, just two doublets, Georgi-Mahatchett model, which has two triplet fields and then the doublet, and the SEPTET model, which is what I'm going to look at later, which is the doublet and also a multiplet of seven particles. So when you have extended models, you want them to have the same predictions for the masses of the W and Z boson. So you can write this, the masses of the W and Z boson, in terms of a weak mixing angle, theta W. So in the standard model, this parameter rho is just going to equal to 1. In extended models, it might not be 1. So the septet happens to be the only multiplet that preserves the rho parameter at tree level. So that's why one of the reasons why we're looking at the septet model. OK, so we have the doublet, like before, and a new septet here. The doublet is needed so it, so that the fermions will get masses, but the septet can generate gauge boson masses. The physical particles are linear combinations of these two fields, so we'll get two neutral Higgs particles, little h and big H, and then A naught will just go away. There'll be different charge scalars, so H plus, and then higher charge particles that are formed from the septet.
So the septet, what is it a representation of?
It's just like, it's similar to the doublet, like it's just a multiplet of, Oh, sorry, those are the charges. Sorry? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it is. But or if you introduce another field, it could get have other properties. And
but the doesn't give
Well, yes, it does. But it sort of combines with the septet. And then they both do.
OK, so the septet doesn't give mass to the
focus? No, it doesn't. OK, so. We can rewrite the Lagrangian, or rather the covariant derivative, in terms of the gauge boson. So after you simplify and rewrite things, you can get the form above here. So here, T plus and T minus are raising and lowering operators. And in Q is the electric charge operator, so just the charge along the diagonal for the different particles. For the doublet, these are can be represented by 2x2 matrices. For the septet, 7x7 matrices, so when you're actually calculating this, you have to multiply everything out, and it takes a while. Mathematica would probably be useful, but I didn't use that. No, it's still SU2, but. Well, I'm not really sure exactly why, but it just how it works out. Like, for example, Q, the electric charge, like we have like plus 5 to negative 2. So, sorry. But yeah, I'm not really sure why. Right, so if we do a similar thing to before, we get the mass terms in the Lagrangian of this form, so for the W and Z boson. And then this will give you the mass here. So here, previously we had v5 squared plus 16 v chi squared being just v squared. So that gives the condition from before at the bottom here that this has to equal the v squared of the standard model. Okay. So there are different Higgs particles that will result from different combinations of the fields in the multiplet. So we have two neutral Higgs particles, little h and big H. Usually they say that the little h corresponds to the standard model Higgs boson that they've already found. singly charged Higgs, a doubly charged Higgs, and then other ones down here that I'm not going to look at in detail. We've also introduced the angle alpha and theta h, just to so we can write these like the fields h and little h and big H in terms of just one parameter. All right, so we can find the couplings of the Higgs particles to different gauge bosons by looking at different terms in the Lagrangian. So these are the terms that are relevant. From the last two terms, we can see the doubly charged Higgs. Here, chi plus 2 is just H plus 2, coupling to the W bosons. And so that gives you a coupling down there. And then the singly charged Higgs, H5, is just H plus. And that will give you the coupling there. So for the little h and big H, it's a bit more complicated. But after you rearrange things and rewrite stuff, you get the Lagrangian at the top. And so that will give you similar couplings to the different gauge bosons. Are those visible, the diagrams? OK. So in the standard model, we have I'm just going to write out the matrix element for things in standard model to compare it to the septet model. In the standard model, we just have the little h, so just one Higgs boson. For the W plus W minus interaction, we have two diagrams here. And that will give you the matrix element, portional S and T. So in the high energy limit, when the energy is much greater than the masses, we can make some approximations and then rewrite it like this. So it's just in terms of the energy squared, which is important later. So for the ZZ interaction, we'll have the matrix element here. This is taking these three diagrams. So that one's partial S, one, the other is T, the other is U. That's using the approximation that S plus T plus U is 0. And then the WZ interaction, we just have one diagram. So you can see the matrix element down there. All right, so in the septet model, the vertex factors that we normally have in the standard model are going to be modified. So we can write that in terms of just a modification constant kappa. So for each interaction, there'll be a different kappa, kappa W, H, and all that. So previously, we rewrote the Lagrangian and got the coupling constants. Comparing that to the previous thing, we can write what the values of kappa are in terms of alpha and theta H. All right, is this visible, the diagram? OK. So in the W plus W minus interaction, we'll have the two neutral Higgs particles like before, but also the doubly charged Higgs. So that will just have this diagram here. So if you rewrite the matrix element in terms of kappa, you'll get the value at the top. So that's just the same as before, but with an extra term for the heavier Higgs and the doubly charged Higgs. So the ZZ interaction just involves the neutral particles, and then the WZ interaction also involves the neutral particles as well as the singly charged one. OK. So when you look at the matrix elements written before, they're usually either proportional to S plus T or T, except for the ZZ one. These are proportional to the energy squared, so that means that for large energies, the matrix element will be unbounded. But obviously, this is a problem because matrix element squared is probability. So it happens that in the standard model, this component is going to be canceled by pure gauge interaction diagrams, so diagrams right here. So we want this to be the same in the septet model. We want to have the cancellation still hold. So this will give us some sum rules between the coupling constants. So this, looking back at the previous matrix element, we want to have the cancellations hold. So we want the matrix element to be the same as the standard model. So this means that we have to have these coupling constants for the WW and WZ interaction equal to 1. There's also another constraint we can get from conservation probability. So this is putting a constraint on the real part of the matrix element. You get this constraint by writing the matrix element in terms of partial waves as a sum over like Legendre polynomials of different angular momentum. I'm not going to write the details, but eventually you get this constraint if you make some, yeah. Sorry? They're the different Higgs bosons. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, but you could, in principle, observe the others. Like the singly and doubly charged Higgs, but yeah, I'll get to that. Right, so if we apply this condition to the three processes above, we get these three constraints. So it gives you an upper limit on the coupling constants. So if you combine this with the sum rules, you get these constraints down here. So the first one is from the W plus W minus interaction. And if you combine them in certain ways, you can get it on the this one by taking big H, the coupling constant for big H to be zero. So that's just giving you an upper limit. All right, so another constraint on the coupling constants can be found from an experiment they did, the LHC, with W boson fusion. There's a paper about it, but the result is they got it for the Georgi-Mahatchett model, which has two triplets and a doublet. But we can translate this to the septet model because they both have a doubly charged Higgs particle. So this will give us a constraint on the coupling constants for certain masses. So in their simulation, they only cover masses from 100 to 700 GeV. And this is just the little diagram of the experiment they did. So if you combine these, you can get, you can plot, this K is actually kappa, kappa for different masses. So anything above the line is excluded. So this is just, so the line is the upper limit. On the left, the maximum value that kappa can take is square root of 15. The starred line is from the experiment, so that is the strongest constraint. And then the decreasing line at the right is the equation above. It's not extended further on because we already have a stronger constraint from the experiment. So this is for the neutral Higgs particle. The black lines for the septet model, the blue lines for the Georgi-Mahatchett model. So if you can do about the same thing for the Georgi-Mahatchett model and get a upper bound on the constraint, on the coupling constant here. So as you can see, its experimental constraint is very similar, but then on the two sides, it's the theoretical constraint is quite different. All right, and so for the singly charged Higgs, we don't have an experimental constraint because there's not the masses are not equal necessarily. So this is just using the line, the curve here is just using the equation above, and it cuts off at square root of 15 because that's the maximum value it can have. All right, so in conclusion, the septet model introduced a septet field in addition to the Higgs doublet. The septet will preserve the row parameter, and it can also help explain some unanswered questions in particle physics. And so using the constraint shown in the graph, it can help guide different searches for new Higgs particles.
Six, six, four, five, four, five, four, five.
why it's a septet? Sorry, like why is it not a triplet or? Well, having 7 preserves the row parameter, which we want to do, so it gets the same value for the W and Z boson masses. Why? Why 7? I'm not really sure why 7, but yeah, sorry. Sorry. Okay, I'll try to get that again. I'm not sure if I'll be able to get this. Oh, okay.
Those factors involving the finding chi could cancel out is a coincidence. I'm just speculating.
All we can do is.
Any questions?
Yeah.
Are there any expectations for like which masses these higher part like Higgs bosons could be expected?
Well, I'm not really sure, but I know they are doing searches for the doubly charged Higgs particle. So, I don't know. Just at least the constraints on there will are related to that as well. Yeah.
So does the septet model help you solve any problems the standard model is facing?
Well, yeah. I mean, for dark matter, at least some of the more like exotic particles that arise from it could account for that. I'm not sure how, but it could help explain neutrino oscillation as well.
What's the constraint on the mass? Sorry, you probably mentioned it, but what's the constraint on the charge that it's now?
The constraint on the charge?
Like how big the mass has to be for it not to be discovered yet?
Oh, I'm not really sure. I can't. I don't think I looked at that.
Why you have to arrange them in a way that's like they have different charges, right? Like some have like 5.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's something symmetric. Yeah. Why is it asymmetric?
Oh, like.
Yeah.
Like you mean like 5?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Even double digits.
I'm not sure why they chose 5, but that's.
Here this one is this charge is an EN charge or is that original U1 charge?
It's just electric charge.
So this charge is after like symmetry breaking, the U1 after symmetry breaking?
I'm not sure.
Usually that's the case.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how many particles are there other than the boson we discussed?
I think I wrote them down. I think it was like 7 or something. I can't remember. Yeah. 10. If you count the ones at the bottom that are just like from the subtype.
Why did we have this split of particles to study and other Higgs particles?
Oh, that's just what I looked at. It's not really, it doesn't really matter.
Oh, okay. So like these are observable.
Those are just ones that like I did the graphs for and stuff.
So like, is there anything you can say about these other Higgs particles? Or?
Well, what I'm not really sure. I mean, the A naught is a Goldstone boson, so it doesn't actually appear. And so the chi plus 2 shouldn't be at the bottom, because it's already at the top. Also the H plus 3, that doesn't couple to Z and W like the H plus does up there. So that's why you can't really look at it in the same way. I'm not sure if it couples to something else, but it doesn't couple to Z and W.
In this model, only the big H can serve as a dark matter candidate.
What?
Because it seems like the rest of them are all charges. But, so only the A0 is a only the big H is a dark matter candidate.
Or if they're charged, any of the ones down here.
But then they would interact electromagnetically. You would see them.
Yeah, I know.
They cannot be dark matter.
No, but some. I don't know. Some people said they were candidates for it. I'm not sure why, but sorry.
What will be the mass of the big H?
Well, we don't really have mass yet. It depends what the coupling constants are. And
but here it seems that it only depends on the part of
your order. So, have there been cosmological models for this big H? Like, in cases is a dark matter candidate, like, what would you? Like, do they have mass expectations for this one, purely based on cosmology, or?
I'm not really sure. They might, but I didn't look at that.
Hello, everyone. Today I'm going to talk about relations among scattering amplitudes. So some people may say it may just be old project and people have done it maybe 50 years ago using S-matrix and Feynman diagrams. But today I'm going to correct this misconception and tell you that it's not true. It's still a hot research topic. So let's start. The outline is I will start from the S-matrix and the scattering amplitudes, like the definition of them and how are they related. And then I will discuss how people solve the scattering amplitudes using Feynman diagrams. And then I will discuss the difficulty of calculating gravity amplitudes using Feynman diagrams. And then in order to solve this problem, we need to simplify our formalization of how to calculate scattering amplitudes. So we study Yamil's theory again, and we study gluon scattering amplitudes, and we use some color decomposition to strip out the color structure, and we get a partial amplitude. And then we will find some very amazing relation between partial amplitudes of different theories, like for scalar theory, gluon theory, and gravity theory. And then some interesting relations between this scattering amplitudes are BCJ and KLT. And we discussed the possibility to find a smaller basis, which is my research topic currently. So this new technique they will discover something novel that cannot be bound by the usual Feynman diagram approach. So from the QFT1 class, we already know that the S-matrix elements are defined in this way. In Heisenberg picture, the S-matrix element is defined using the overlap between the initial state and the final state. So if the theory is free, the S-matrix is just identity. There's no interaction. But if there is interaction, the S matrix will become 1 plus IT, and T is the interacting part. And the scattering amplitudes are defined M as M here. It is related with the Hess matrix by a delta function. And it tells us the momentum conservation that we can. So the reason why I write sum over p equal to zero is like we can use crossing symmetry to turn all the inward going particles to outgoing. So it simplifies a little, but it's not that important. And then how do we calculate scattering amplitudes using Feynman diagrams? So the traditional way to compute that is like we, by definition, we relate the scattering amplitudes with S matrix. And from LSZ formula, which we are maybe familiar with from the QFT class, it's related with the correlation function. And those correlation functions can be computed using Feynman diagrams by some weak contraction and some theorems. So we can use the Feynman diagrams to compute the scattering amplitudes. Okay, so far so good. So it seems like the problem can be solved. So then, but the Feynman diagrams seem to be very powerful, and it is used nearly everywhere. It appears in every textbook of quantum field theory, and it's used in calculating some high energy experiments, and it's also used in condensed matter. So it seems to be very powerful, but I want to ask the question is that are there any disadvantages of this Feynman diagram approach? And the answer is yes. So one thing about this approach is that the Lagrangian is necessary. Somebody may ask, well, is this a disadvantage? But yes, it is. Like usually for QED, we write the Lagrangian and we just read from the Lagrangian the electron-electron scattering, and we can draw the Feynman diagram, and we use the Feynman diagram to compute the scattering process. But in some string theory, like conformal field theory, we can use the conformal symmetry to fix the correlation function exactly without using any Lagrangian or Feynman diagram thing. All we need is conformal symmetry. That is the conformal bootstrap approach. And even in some theories like topological quantum field theory, we don't even have a Lagrangian. So how do we compute Feynman diagram from a theory without even a Lagrangian? So this reveals some shortcomings of the Feynman diagram approach. And another thing of this approach is that the number of diagrams grows factorially, even at the tree level. So like this is very famous, and people always know that it's hard to compute Feynman diagrams, but how hard it is. Like 60 years ago, some people calculated the number of QED amplitudes using some counting technique, and they have found the number of amplitudes, the diagrams, grows factorially. So like for 8 particles, we already have millions of diagrams, and we need to compute each of them and then sum over them together. And even with the help of computer, it is not always an easy thing to do it, because the computer has enough, don't always have infinite power. So we cannot always rely on the computer. And up to now, is the computer has not made too much progress. I think like in LHC, people could only compute like eight particle process and loop process with like two loop for some hard process, and maybe for some easy process is 5 loops. And then I will discuss the gravity amplitudes. Of course, we can use Feynman diagram to compute the gravity amplitudes. It's possible to do it. And we start from the Einstein-Hilbert action, and we calculate the functional derivative. Like the first one is the three-point graviton interaction, and the second one is four-point interaction. Like here, we have already used some shorthand notation, like we use permutation and we symmetrize it. So in fact, the whole calculation is much more difficult than this. So in principle, we can do it. And people have done some calculation about gravity amplitudes, but it is really, really hard. And that's also, okay. This is a 3-point graviton vertex, and this is a 4-point vertex. So you can say the functional derivation, like derivative S over 3 graviton, and you guys got 3 graviton vertex. Okay, so in principle we can do it, but it turns out really hard. So people have developed some novel techniques which much simplified this calculation. So the fastest way is BCFW, but I'm not going to talk about it today. I'm going to talk about another thing really interesting that relates the gauge theory to the gravity amplitude. So we don't even have to compute this process, and we can use something called KLT relation to get the gravity amplitude directly. So this is much more simpler. And then I discuss gauge theory before we discuss KLT relation. So in Yuan Yang-Mills theory, we have gluon scattering, like in the Euro-Feynman diagram approach, as 3-point gluon vertex and 4-point gluon vertex. And this seems to be complicated. So we translate the, like FABC can be regarded as a generator in adjoint representation. So we translate this adjoint representation to fundamental representation by using some identity. And then we have, if we observe the some generator relation, we can use these two relations to decompose a tree amplitude into a sum over partial amplitude and the color part. So actually, what we are doing now is to strip out all those color structure, and which are written here, and keep only the kinematic part. We call it partial amplitude. So in this way, we can decompose the tree full amplitude into two parts, the kinematic part and the color part. And it will simplify our calculation. So let's discuss our partial amplitude. So it contains only the kinematic information, and it depends on our perturbation, which is called An, sigma 1 to n. So the sigma is the permutation of this n particles. And a natural question to ask is, are there any relations between these partial amplitudes? And the answer is yes. So we can see from here that because the trace has cyclic property, we can recover this relation easily. So the number of independent partial amplitudes will be reduced to n minus 1 factorial. And then we can use the classical relations to reduce the basis to n minus 2 factorial dimension. Like here, the coefficients are plus or minus 1. And then three people, BCJ, they found a new relation that if we include minus 10 variables at the coefficient, we can reduce further the number of independent amplitudes to n minus 3 factorial. And this satisfies for any dimension. OK. Actually, it's not very simple to prove it by hand, by moving hand. But so the KK relation is can be understood as to have. The KK relation can be understood as some. The first line?
Why is it a single trace of the
Okay, let me come back. So they are like the structure constant in each vertex, right? And we can write them in some trace, like binomial. And then if we calculate only tree amplitude, we can multiply this trace together, right? and we write it using some matrix. And then an interesting thing is that if we multiply two traces by using this identity, we will glue on two traces together. So they will become one trace. So finally, it will be only one trace left. OK. So these relations, like the KK relation, can be discussed, can be proved using like something like U1 decoupling identity and BCJ. I will discuss later. So then let's turn to another theory. We call it bi-adjoint scalar theory. So this theory has some flavor groups. And usually we in gauge theory, we discuss local symmetry. We call it gauge symmetry. But here, the difference of this one is that the flavor group has some global symmetry called UN by UN tilde. And the reason we need two flavors is that if we have only one, you see the structure constant is anti-symmetric, and two phi will be symmetric, so it will vanish. So we'll need at least two flavor groups. And then we can do similar things with before, like for gauge theory, we can use flavor decomposition to decompose scalar amplitude into some double flavor. Like these are the flavor structure, and this is the kinematic part. So we call it double partial amplitude. And it can be solved easily by using a sum over kinematic graphs, similar to Feynman diagrams. And I will show later that this amplitude will be a part of our unexpected relations between scalar, gauge, and gravity theories. OK, so let me turn back to BCJ relation. The Mandelstam variables are the Sij, and it's a momentum squared. So we have these Mandelstam variables as coefficients, and we can discover some relations between partial scattering amplitudes. Like for four particle, we have 4 − 3 factorial, that is one basis. So every partial amplitude can be expressed using this A1, 2, 3, 4. And the coefficients are the Mandelstam variables. And for 5 particle, we have two bases, two dimensional bases. And every partial amplitude can be written in this way. So that's something we have. We cannot, although we can compute Feynman diagrams and find it, but the way people found it is not in this way. So it's kind of, they use like color kinematic duality. So you might remember we have a Jacobi identity for the gauge group, and the BCJ have discovered a new Jacobi identity for kinematic part. So the color part and the kinematic part are kind of dual to each other. And by using the Jacobi identity, we can find these relations called BCJ relation using the kinematic version of Jacobi identity. Okay.
What do the curly brackets mean in the argument on the left-hand side of the second formula?
Which one? This one?
The curly bracket for example around 4 to the left.
Oh, yes. This one. Oh, this just 1, 2, 4, 3. It doesn't mean anything. It's just. I think because usually, like in the KK relation, we will brace them together, but it doesn't mean anything. So maybe they just follow this notation. I don't know, but it's not important. So it's just you piece them together. Yeah, you can fix 3 of them. Yeah. Martin, do you have a question?
Yeah, no, it was like in the equation where you first time solved the curly brackets, it was like permutations which are part of OP brackets, alpha brackets, beta. What is the OP? That was my question.
that's not our key point here, but I will explain a little. So OP is just some permutation that satisfy the same, like if you put alpha and beta t together, beta t is the inverse version of beta, and you put them together, but you do not disturb the order of alpha and beta t. So you just keep alpha before beta t. So that's what OP means. But if you want more details, you need to ask me later or refer to the paper. So okay, so then let's come to a more surprising relation between amplitudes called KLT relations. So the origin of the KLT relation is like, it looks very simple. Like we have two copies of open string and we piece them together and we will get closed string. So it's like sketchily is like closed string is equal to open string squared and the form is like this. It's originally discovered by three people. And only after like 10 years, people have found that we can use this relation actually in field theory, that the closed string usually represents the gravitons and open string represents some matter or gluons. So we can translate this formula into another language. Like we say this, so actually it can be proved, but generally speaking, the closed string becomes the gravity amplitude and the open string becomes the gauge amplitude. So that is our field theory version of KLT relation. And the gravity amplitude can be represented using a square of gauge amplitude. So that is really amazing. We don't have to calculate any Feynman diagrams and using that complicated vertex. All we need is to compute the gauge amplitude and the scalar amplitude. So the thing in the middle is scalar amplitude inverse. So all we need is the gauge theory and the scalar theory information, and we get gravity amplitude. So it's the first, maybe not the first time, but it reveals the very amazing relation between different theories.
So is this at tree level still?
Yeah, it's at tree level, but people have made some progress in loop level, but the form is not so clear, so, but it exists. So,
it doesn't care about what gauge group the
gauge group?
Of the
yeah. So first in loop for loop amplitude, we cannot use color decomposition. It's like there are single decomposition, triple double decomposition. So there will be many parts. But another interesting thing is that we can use only tree amplitude to find all the information loop amplitude by using something called unitary cut. So yeah, by cutting the loop, we can talk about tree amplitude only, and by gluing them together, we can discuss loop amplitude. So, but that's not the main point today. So. It will be approved later, but in the original version, the M inverse, people didn't realize it's the scalar amplitude inverse, but they write it as S beta alpha. So the reason why I added this is that I'm going to prove that we can write the matrix in between as inverse of a scalar amplitude. Okay. So then we'll introduce Cartazzo-He-Yuan formalism to prove the surprising and somewhat mysterious BCJ and KLT relation. So this comes from a twister string theory. And basically speaking, this theory is like a string theory whose target space is twister space, and twister space is a set of null geodesics. The key point of the CHY formalism and the scattering equations. So we solve these equations and we sum over these solutions, we can get the amplitudes. So here the sigmas are the punctures on the Riemann sphere. Like if we have n punctures and we have SL2C symmetry, so we can always fix 3 points on the Riemann sphere, like say sigma 1 equal to 0, sigma 2 equal to 1, sigma 3 equal to infinity. And they can all, so this is like a global symmetry. Every sigma can be translated in this way. And so it's somewhat like string amplitude, like if we use conformal symmetry and we deform the Riemann sphere, like we puncture, we have n punctures on the Riemann sphere, we can stretch it and we get a particle string amplitude. So, and then the building blocks of the CH5 formalism are CN alpha. We write it like this, it's a function of sigma. And we have another one is Fuffing prime psi. I'm not going to write it explicitly because not that important, but it is well defined and we can write the psi and the definition of Fuffing prime. And then every amplitude, no matter it's scalar amplitude, gauge amplitude, or gravity amplitude, they can all be written in this way. And all we need is to solve the scattering equation, which is written in the last page. And then we can evaluate all these components on these solutions, and we sum over them, and we can get any amplitude we want. So like for scalar theory, the I left is CN alpha, and I right is CN beta. And for the gauge partial amplitude, the I left is CN alpha, and I right is Fuffing prime. And for the gravity, is both I left and IR are Fuffing prime. So we can unify all this amplitude in the same formula. So this is really amazing. And we can use this formalism to prove more things like BCG and KLT. So let me show you how to prove it. So we use this notation. We call like X sigma I as X sigma evaluated at the ith solution of the scattering equation. And we write these components using some matrices. And then we can rewrite our CHY formula using this matrices. Like for scalar partial amplitude, we can write it like L T D R, and then we can solve the D inverse by using some very simple linear algebra. And like for any amplitude, again by using some linear algebra, and we can divide the amplitude into 3 parts. One is I L D R, and another is M inverse, and another is L T D I R. So that's the reason why I added the M inverse in the KLT relation. And this, the left part and the right part are both amplitudes. So like for BCJ, we choose I left to be CN gamma and I right to be the Fuffing prime psi. So this part will become the scalar amplitude. And the red part will become one CN and one Fuffing prime. So it will become Young-Mills partial amplitude. So, but the gamma and alpha are different. So actually we can use n minus 3 factorial basis to expand any amplitude, any n factorial amplitude using BCG relation. So we rediscovered the BCG relation using some simple linear algebra in CH5 formalism. And for the KLT, we choose I left and I right both to be Fuffing prime. And then both the left and the right will become the Young-Mills amplitude. And then we can rediscover the KLT relation still in the CH5 formalism. So that the gravity is equal to gauge squared. So let me conclude the lecture today. I will not take you too much time. So first I discussed S matrix and Feynman diagrams and the difficulty in computing gravity amplitudes. And then I introduced some novel techniques like partial amplitudes. And I talk about relations between these partial amplitudes. And if you go back today, only sentence I want you to remember that is that the gravity is equal to gauge squared. So this is something that Feynman diagram cannot do it. So, and my research topic is about something special. Is there something special in four dimension? It's so considering the Lorentz structure of the space-time, we may wonder if there's some more random relation between this partial amplitudes in four dimension. And the answer is yes. And we are now trying to discover a smaller basis in four dimension. And the number is much more smaller than n minus 3 factorial. So these are my references today. And thank you all for attending this talk. And so thank you very much. Okay.
Is there like a holographic interpretation for this, to this relationship between the gravity amplitude and
the its gravity duality? Yeah, I think people, there's a paper I can send you later about BCJ. Like actually BCJ can be, the BCJ relation can be expressed using some string theory amplitude. So actually BCJ relation can either be a field theory amplitude relation or a string theory amplitude relation. So I think the answer is yes. But for KLT, I'm not sure. Maybe you can rewrite the gauge amplitude using some string amplitude. But I'm not sure what. Yeah, I think the original version is, of KLT is the string version. And there is a field version. So I'm not sure that if that answers the question.
When you say gravity amplitudes, do you mean graviton scattering of gravitons?
Yeah, that's graviton scattering.
So it doesn't couple to any matter or anything?
Yeah, we can add gluons and fermions, but I think they all need to be massless, and the formula will be slightly changed, but I think we can couple it. Yeah, but the reason why I discuss only graviton scattering is because it's simple. Like we only discuss gluon scattering, but we can add the fermions to gluon scattering. So that is possible.
Yeah.
Okay, Martin.
So you basically got this basically powerful formula from the CHY formalism thing. That looked weird to me. Can you go back to that one?
Okay. All right. Which one?
Yeah, that one. The second formula. So the sum with b equals not a, blah, blah, blah. Is there like any way I can get some interpretation for that which doesn't include like, you know, two extra courses in string theory? Or?
So you want to study the origin of CHY?
Yeah, like where does this formula come from? Not exactly, but
vague. So actually in 2003, Witten discovered the twister string theory. So like twister was discovered a long time ago and people, but Witten is the first to realize that we can use string theory by adding twister. And then people discovered some very powerful formalism called like Witten RSV formalism. And so they started to, so like it starts from 2003 and they realized we can use the twister string theory to compute scattering amplitudes. And then CHY realized we can further do some, like we borrow that simplification and they realized the BCJ and maybe there's some better way to prove KLT, so they discovered CHY. But I'm not so familiar with that paper, so maybe I can refer to you later if you want to. And if you want to discuss, we can discuss.
Because this holds for any dimensional Minkowski space, or like
yes, for any dimensional, yeah, Minkowski space. So, yeah, so. like in five dimension, we can like gluon a propagator and we get loop amplitude. So we can discuss it in any dimension. And the reason why we need dimension is that we can compactify the theory like in higher dimension to our four dimension null space time to get some loop amplitude relation or something more interesting. So yeah, it is true for any dimension.
Any more questions? I have one more question. Does supersymmetry play a role in this?
Actually, for tree level, no, because usually, if we add supersymmetry, we need for each boson, we have a fermion, right? But fermion only appears in loop diagram for a supersymmetric theory. So for tree level, we don't have to worry about supersymmetry because the supersymmetry amplitude is the same as the normal amplitude. Yeah.
But in loop, does it help or something?
In loop, but usually people don't consider that. They still use tree amplitude. So I'm not sure. Yeah, so in like there are a lot of papers relating the CHY and people, so for a supersymmetric theory, we need to add the multiplex, so the form will be slightly changed.
Are there any more questions?
Thank you very much.